Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the escalating fight against the Koch brothers in the United States Senate, where the majority leader announced Thursday he plans to hold a vote that would grant Congress the authority to regulate and limit the raising and spending of money for federal political campaigns. A longtime observer of Congress and politics, Norman Ornstein, who writes a weekly column for the National Journal and The Atlantic called Congress Inside Out, joins us to discuss the strategy behind the increasingly combative rhetoric coming from Harry Reid, who has vowed to overturn the Supreme Court's Citizens United, McCutcheon and Buckley v. Valeo decisions. Then we will speak with Mark Ames, the founding editor of the satirical Moscow biweekly The Exile, who is now a senior editor at Pando Daily, where he has an article, Sorry America, Ukraine Isn't All About You. In contrast to the current alarmist versus apologists debate over Putin's assertive new Russia that either attributes the Ukraine crisis to the actions of an evil empire builder or blames the West for pushing Putin into a corner where he had no choice but to grab Crimea, we will discuss the missing piece, and that is Putin's domestic agenda that Mark Ames sees as being remarkably similar to Nixon's appeal to the silent majority in red state America. Then finally, we'll examine the fading political fortunes of Turkey's Prime Minister Erdogan, who first appeared as a charismatic modernizer, but this year has stumbled from one crisis to another and now seems to be digging the hole deeper with his insensitive and callous handling of a mining disaster that has left about 300 miners dead with 150 missing. Asla Bali, a professor at the UCLA School of Law who deals with Turkish issues and visits Turkey often, joins us to discuss how this apparently tone-deaf leader maintains a hold on Turkish politics. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, who's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a longtime observer of Congress and politics, and he writes a weekly column for the National Journal and The Atlantic called Congress Inside Out. Mr. Ornstein led a working group of scholars and practitioners that helped shape the law known as McCain-Feingold that reformed the campaign financing system. His many books include The Permanent Campaign and Its Future, The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track, and most recently, the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-written with Thomas Mann. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And it seems like that Harry Reid is really on a sort of stem winder there, taking to the floor of the Senate and railing against the Koch brothers and now talking about backing a constitutional amendment. That, of course, is a long haul. Is there some strategy behind the rhetoric?
Yeah, this is not just a sort of fit of anger aimed at two people. There is a strategy here. The constitutional amendment, which has been proposed by Tom Udall of New Mexico, and which Reid is going to bring up for a vote, he knows that that's not going to occur in the near run or perhaps ever. But if you've got something out there and you get people who have to vote on it, you raise the profile of the issue of money in politics. And if you focus on the Koch brothers, you personalize it in a way that doesn't resonate with voters, and at this point, especially the Democratic Party's base voters, in the same way as an abstract appeal against the 1% would do. You know, the timing is, I think, a good one for him on this because, of course, we've just had the McCutcheon decision by the Supreme Court, which took the terrible, in my view, Citizens United decision and made it infinitely more terrible. What John Roberts has done in his opinion in this McCutcheon decision is, first of all, to move from just independent money, which is not independent as we know, but independent of the candidates, to opening up enormous floodgates back from where we had been before the McCain-Feingold bill for money directly given to parties, which will be directed to candidates. And it's remove corruption other than direct quid pro quo corruption of the American hustle or abscam variety, a bribe that's captured on videotape, from any consideration in the role of money in politics. Now individuals can give, in a cycle, $3.75 million to party committees that can be channeled directly to candidates. It means a couple can give $7.5 million. And you look at the tens or hundreds of millions that the Koch brothers have put in their independent money, now throw in the money that they can do directly, and they're going to pursue not just an ideological interest of quote-unquote freedom, but their own pecuniary interests. They're going to do things that meet their business test. They're worth combined, it appears, $100 billion. So a few hundred million here or there is the equivalent of me taking you out to lunch at the In-N-Out Burger. it's nothing to them. And it's a direct threat to the policy arena, and brings us back to the Gilded Age. Focusing it on two individuals, even though many, many more will be involved, helps to gain some traction to get people uneasy, as they should be, about this wild, wild west of money and politics.
So I guess, Norman Ornstein, the Koch brothers are sort of perfect poster boys. The only one that you could do better would be Donald Sterling, right?
Donald Sterling or Clive Von Bundy if he had a lot of money. Of course, he has a lot of our money because he's basically cheated the rest of us taxpayers. But, you know, Donald Sterling is certainly a figure of immense notoriety. The Koch brothers may not be the only ones they're not who are doing this. Of course, we've got Sheldon Adelson and many others. They may, in the end, not be the worst, but they certainly are two poster boys for using vast wealth to overwhelm the rest of us who don't have that vast wealth in not just influencing elections, but the drive for money for politicians. If you tell them, I'll give you a whole bundle of money, but there's just one thing I want in the policy arena, or I can take my money elsewhere, you're going to have some sway over what happens in policy, policy that affects all of us, but could enrich their bottom line immensely.
So the bill that you mentioned, the Udall bill that Harry Reid is putting up for a vote, which you suggested was somewhat tilting at windmills, but it does actually address the whole DNA of the undoing of campaign finance reform in this country that you worked on in terms of McCain-Feingold, because it's not just trying to undo Citizens United or McCutcheon, it's also going back to Buckley v. Vallejo, isn't it?
It absolutely is. And in effect, what Roberts did with this most recent McCutcheon decision, even though he used language that suggested he was following in the tradition of Buckley, Buckley had a very different definition of corruption, a much broader one, and believed that the appearance of corruption was an adequate reason to put some restrictions on campaign money. Roberts, in effect, turned Buckley on its head and is well along the way towards decimating it entirely. What we've seen is decades of even a more than a century of campaign law and regulation that's been thrown out by this court. And it's a dangerous thing. The constitutional amendment, I support the effort that Reid is involved in, because we have to get a much broader public sensitivity to what this means. It's democracy being bought and sold in a fashion that we have not seen in this country in a very long time. And while John McCain himself says this is just going to lead us to some other massive scandal and that will bring an impetus for change, without a different Supreme Court, that impetus for change is not going to take us very far. So it's a difficult time right now, and anything we can do to gain some public sensitivity to this is really important.
Well, Norman Ornstein, does that mean then that these Judiciary Committee hearings that are going to be starting soon with Senators Tom Udall of New Mexico and Michael Bennett of Colorado, will they get the kind of attention that will put this issue on the front burner?
I don't know the answer to that, Ian. I think we're a ways away from that. There are many other things that, as we know, are motivating people right now. They're focused more on their daily lives and the sluggish economy than on the larger politics. And where they're focused on the larger politics, the attitude that so many Americans have is just, of course it's corrupt, it's awful, it's worse than it's been, to hell with them all. But I think you have to begin somewhere. And beginning by getting a hook. The constitutional amendment is one hook. The focus on the Koch brothers is a second. You've got to be able to grab attention, and I think this will help. as the hearings will as well.
But how do the Democrats get over the problem? It seems that the Republicans are a more natural fit with the wealthy and the powerful in this country, whereas the Democrats seem to have a dilemma. They get their votes from ordinary people, but they get most of their money from the same people the Republicans get their money from. Isn't that the...
That's a very good point. And the fact is that many of the party operatives on the Democratic side are not there that happy with reform. Even if Republicans manage to get more money out of the super wealthy, Democrats get plenty of their own. This is not just a problem of Republicans responding to the interests of the ultra wealthy. Imagine if you are a Democratic legislator and a leader, say, of a committee, and 10 wealthy people come into your office and take out their checkbooks and say, you know, along with my spouse, I can give $7.5 million right now and write those checks to a variety of party committees that can go to help you and your colleagues in the next election. Or I can put the checkbook away and the rest of my colleagues can. $75 million going elsewhere. All we want is a little thing here or there. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, that's going to grab your attention. And that's a big part of the problem here. And, of course, along with an effort to get a constitutional amendment, you've also got to look at some other reform ideas. You have to protect the IRS so that at least we get some disclosure. Republicans now are not only for unlimited money, but for blocking disclosure of who's giving that money, which is a different position than they took before we had the McCain-Feingold reforms. But we could also use a kind of reform that I and others have proposed that would empower small donors, that would give, you know, multiple matching funds for candidates who get over a threshold, so it's not just free money, but show that they can demonstrate some wide base of support with smaller donors. That doesn't level the playing field, but at least tilts it a little bit back away from the ultra wealthy.
So in terms of what McCutcheon's done, and since you worked on McCain-Feingold, Norman Ornstein, it would seem to me that we're going back to the days of soft money, right? And that I remember that the Democrats like soft money.
And the next bill coming forward, by the way, the next court case coming forward, the Republican National Committee has already moved a lawsuit that they want to take to the Supreme Court to bring back soft money, period. The fact is that these $3.75 million so-called limits that McCutcheon has opened up really does bring back soft money. It's almost unlimited donations by wealthy individuals. So we're already well down that path.
But do we know?
Nonsense.
But do we know, Norman, whether or not how this is going to break down? Will it favor both equally or one over the other in terms of the Democrats and the Republicans?
I think in the short and medium term, it gives some benefit to Republicans. The fact is, right now, the people who can write checks worth tens of millions of dollars, the big hedge fund people, the financial institution people, the wealthy business owners, the people like the Koch brothers, tend far more to be Republicans than Democrats. They tend to be people, especially now, who want desperately to keep their low tax rates, hedge fund people with the carried interest rate being so much lower than what people who make their money from wages pay. The low rates for multimillionaires and billionaires, and Republicans are much more in favor of lower tax rates or lower taxes on the rich. Now, there are certainly Democrats among the very wealthy. One who's become very visible is Tom Steyer. The one Republicans have always used as a pinata, of course, is George Soros, who, interestingly, has fairly much dropped out of the political giving game. And there are some in Hollywood, some maybe even listening to this program.
Right. Well, that I remember in the days of soft money that you could always count, or the Democrats could always count on Steven Spielberg writing a big check. And presumably that will come back. But as you pointed out, the playing field is hardly level given the predominance of money on the Republican side. But in terms of this long haul of a constitutional amendment, that's almost an abstraction. That doesn't grab me as an immediate campaign issue here as we approach the midterms.
Yeah, this is not going to motivate huge numbers of people in the midterms. What it might do in the short run is a couple of things. First, Democrats in the midterm elections need to get a slightly higher turnout. It doesn't have to be huge, from their normal base voters who tend to turn out in presidential campaigns but less in midterms. Younger voters, women, minorities, and ideological activists. The ideological activists are demoralized right now. They're not as likely to turn out. And the fact that a Republican victory in the Senate would give even more traction to the Koch brothers and others may increase that motivation a little bit. At the same time, we know that there will be even more of these hatchet job ads being run in a lot of Senate and House contests. We've already seen a substantial number of them, and they're going to come from organizations like Americans for Prosperity, which is backed by the Koch brothers and many of the outfits in which they're involved. And being able to showcase those ads as having come from sources that now other people recognize as having the intent that they do may make those ads a little bit less effective. So that, I think, is the goal in the short run.
But do you think the fact that President Obama has been scolding the Democrats lately and saying that they almost have a congenital defect in not showing up for midterms, given his poll ratings, is that likely to motivate the young in particular to come out and vote?
No, I don't think that it's at all likely to motivate younger voters. But a combination of things, including the realization that a Republican victory is going to give even more traction to people like the Koch brothers, might have an impact.
Well, just in closing, Norman Ornstein, I guess the main thing that the Democrats seem to count on is that the Republicans are going to screw up. And I suppose, in a way, nobody is more of a poster boy for being against campaign finance and unlimited money than Mitch McConnell. And he has his own problems in this race. But his statement today saying today's proposal by the Senate Majority Leader represents an all-out assault on the right to free speech. I don't think that's going to win too many hearts and minds, do you?
No, and, you know, I've written an awful lot about what Mitch McConnell has said and done in the past on the campaign reform front. And in particular, McConnell, for many years, was the most ardent proponent of disclosure you could find. Only when that turned to his own disadvantage did he suddenly begin to disown it and move in a different direction. I don't think he's a very credible spokesperson on this front.
Well, Norman Ornstein, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein, who's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a longtime observer of Congress and politics. And he writes a weekly column for the National Journal and the Atlantic called Congress Inside Out. Mr. Ornstein led a working group of scholars and practitioners that helped shape the law known as McCain-Feingold that reformed the campaign financing system. And his many books include The Permanent Campaign and Its Future, The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track. And his most recent book, co-authored with Thomas Mann, is It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. We're going to take a brief station break and be back looking into Vladimir Putin's domestic agenda that our guest sees as being remarkably similar to Nixon's appeal to the silent majority in red state America.
What's my name? What's my station? Oh, just tell me what I should do. I don't need to be kind to the armies of night that would do such injustice to you. Or bow down. They should take all that you see to the men who move on me in dimly lit halls and determine my future.
Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Ames, the founding editor of the satirical Moscow biweekly, The Exile. He's a senior editor at Pando Daily and the author of Going Postal, Rage, Murder, and Rebellion, From Reagan's Workplace to Clinton's Columbine, as well as co-author of The Exile, Sex, Drugs, and Libel in the New Russia. His latest article at Pando Daily is Sorry, America, Ukraine Isn't All About You. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Ames.
Thanks for having me on.
And Mark, the idea that the narrative here in the West, and particularly in the United States, is that either Putin is behaving evilly because he fears America's empire or liberty and freedom, or Putin is behaving perfectly rationally because the evil American empire has bullied Putin into a corner, forcing him to annex Crimea and support pro-Russian separatists. That's the both the narrative from Washington and from what we could loosely call the opposition here in the United States. But you think there's clearly a deeper story here.
Yeah, well, that doesn't account for the domestic politics that have been going on in Russia, the culture war stuff, which is new for Putin. Now, he didn't wage a culture war against gays. He didn't wage a culture wars against the decadent West in his first two terms in office from late 99 until 2008. And it doesn't really give a larger picture. And also, it obviously leaves out what we know to be true here, which is all politics are local. And I don't mean necessarily local in the Jeffersonian sense that it's down to the little village and community. I just mean Russia. Putin acts in ways that have to do with whatever internal dynamic he's dealing with in his country to try to enhance and keep his power. And that doesn't seem to be brought up hardly at all in everything I hear about what's going on in Ukraine. Everybody's trying to decide whether either Putin has caught the imperialist gene that supposedly is endemic to Russian leaders, to most Russian leaders, or people who are sort of on the other side who are against American interventionism and, going back to the Bush years and what we did in Iraq. I think very, very mistakenly regard Putin as, as a check on American power, as some kind of bulwark or even sort of he's standing for something that maybe the left or the anti-interventionist crowd agrees with. And I just find that, I think there are, bits of truths and all of that, definitely, but it's a very myopic and sort of America-centric way of framing something that's going on that's very different and alien and not all about us. And what that is that Putin's domestic calculations, his domestic political calculations, have changed dramatically from the last time he was in office, from late 99 through 2008. And the time that he returned in 2011. And you may recall that he became president in early 2012, but really he announced that he was returning to office, switching seats with President Medvedev. He announced this in October of 2011. And there was a lot of genuine outrage against Putin that I'd never seen before from the sort of the middle class yuppies, the manager classes, as they called them in Russia, mostly Moscow and a couple of the other big cities. They were genuinely really outraged that Putin so crudely just said, okay, I'm switching seats with my puppet and you people just, rubber stamp it. And personally, I haven't been to Russia in a while. They shut down my paper and it wasn't the best going away that I used to run in Russia. But in any event, when they had their parliamentary elections in December of 2011, and there was the usual amount of vote rigging and vote fraud, I think everybody was shocked, especially Putin, by the size and fury and the motion of the anti-Putin protests that broke out, especially in Moscow. I mean, there was something like 100,000 people, most of them were young, most of them were middle class. And these were the people who really formed the they're really the most important base for Putin, because Russia is such a kind of a top-down, you know, hierarchical culture, and power is so centralized in Moscow. And so what became clear, I think, at that point, and Putin is an incredibly savvy political figure, whatever else you say about him, he really is, quickly understood that he had lost the big city liberal and yuppie IT lawyer, accountant, you know, marketing guy, whatever. He lost that demographic. And from their point of view, you know, this was war. And Putin very quickly and pretty deftly changed his politics. And it's what I describe. I mean, you know, I hate to use, again, another American or Western analogy, but it, you know, it is sort of like this. Used the sort of Nixon strategy, that is waging a culture war, heating up the differences and the resentments in the regions against the urban liberals who now turned on him. That meant going after gays in a way he never did all the previous 12 years, demonizing gays, a very violent, vicious, horrific campaign against gays that had been waged, and it just started a couple years ago. And at the same time, tightening the screws, basically completely tightening the screws on the internet and on what remained of the free press. And what remained of the free press really was on the internet, and that's basically gone now. And, you know, this war, it's not something that Putin saw. That wouldn't make sense, because he already had his man in power in Ukraine. But in a very dark, cynical way, to his own personal credit, I guess you'd call it, he understood the angle right away and responded to this crisis in a much more aggressive and anti-Western fashion than he has to previous crises in the past. And that is, again, the politics of sort of pandering to the Russian red states, or the Russian silent majority, who are resentful, who've been left out of the economic boom. They've been completely left behind. They don't like Muscovites, the young, rich Muscovites, and the young, rich Muscovites despise them. So this is a different Putin and a different politics.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Ames, who's the founding editor of the satirical Moscow biweekly, The Exile. He's now a senior editor at Pando Daily and the author of Going Postal, Rage, Murder, and Rebellion, From Reagan's Workplace to Clinton's Columbine, as well as co-author of The Exile, Sex, Drugs, and Libel in the New Russia. His latest article at Pando Daily is Sorry, America, Ukraine Isn't All About You. So given the analogies with Nixon's domestic strategy here in the terms of going after the silent majority, pandering to red state America, and you've got, in effect, Putin, I guess, is living in occupied territory there, surrounded by the elite that despise him. And of course, Nixon had an equal contempt for the liberal elite as well, as I imagine Putin has. And of course, we don't understand the depth of national humiliation that Russia went through, from being a superpower one day to, you know, begging for aid the next. And you could make the case that the entire country is suffering from a kind of form of post-traumatic stress disorder as a result of that. And he's clearly tapping into it. But on the moral majority side, which is combining both the silent majority with the moral majority, it's definitely seems to, for example, the European Song Contest seemed to play right into Putin's hands. The winner was this drag queen from Austria, the bearded lady, as she's called, in a sequin dress with incredible makeup, except for this strange and contrasting beard. And the runners-up were these two perky little Russian twins who sang patriotic songs. And, of course, all of Russia is furious. And there you have the comparison between the moral, upright Russians that Putin is pandering to and these decadent Westerners.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, look, change is traumatic in general, and really rapid change is more traumatic. But you add into it what you talked about, not just the humiliation of losing their empire, but real genuine economic suffering from the time that, you know, Yeltsin began his rule with shock therapy reforms. You know, the economy collapsed some 60%. You had the average male life expectancy of a Russian drop from around 68 years to under 57 in the 1990s. You know, you all of a sudden had people who had who lived a sort of, it wasn't like they didn't live great or anything, but they didn't worry about starving, and they didn't deal with the stress suddenly of living in a really highly competitive culture where, you know, a handful of people now are driving around with new Mercedes Benz and had unbelievable wealth, and you and everybody else had absolutely nothing and didn't know what your future was. And that is really the most traumatic thing of all, I think. And I think that explains, for example, why so many people in that part of the world, and it's not just Russia, you know, say that the collapse of the Soviet Union was a tragedy for them, was a horrible thing. But that doesn't always lead to something good or sympathetic. You know, it's very easy to exploit different parts of that resentment, anything that has to do with change, you know, the cultural change, the exposure to the West and to what seems like decadence, the consumer culture, et cetera, et cetera. And it's not just the bearded woman, whatever, the singer from Austria, but it seems like every corner Putin turns when, you know, when things are reaching ahead, there's always something there that he can exploit, some cultural thing particularly. For example, you know, when he first took power in early 2012, when he moved back to the Kremlin, the opposition, particularly in Moscow and some of the other cities, was really big, really strong, very threatening, and very organized, very impressive. The leader, Navalny, you know, he's not a liberal in our sense. He's not a progressive liberal in our sense. He's quite a nationalist. A Russian liberal or whoever replaces Putin could also be a nationalist of a different type. But in any event, they really were very impressive, and it scared and rocked the Kremlin, the powers that be. And then suddenly you had Pussy Riot appear. And that this was like a godsend to the Kremlin. And, you know, as much as I like Pussy Riot, and, you know, we love out here punk rebels who get in trouble with the law and the man just for offending people. When the, you know, that hasn't happened since the 70s in the West. And that happened there. But what people don't quite understand here is how that was a godsend to Putin, because almost nobody likes Pussy Riot. And in fact, that really was a divisive issue even among the anti-Putin urban Moscow opposition. To Russians, they were just flat out offensive. They were mocking them. They were mocking Russian culture, mocking Russian institutions by playing punk in the main church in the center of Moscow. And Putin and the Kremlin were very skilled in the way that they manipulated that so that they conflated, in the average Russian's eyes, opposition to the Kremlin with Pussy Riot. Pussy Riot is decadence. It's, I'm saying to these people, it's decadence, it's chaos, which is something that all Russians ultimately fear because of the history of their state. And it's alien. And so, you know, you had that, and then you had, again, with the Ukraine crisis, I mean, you know, whatever you say about how valid the uprising was or how involved we were, I mean, I think all the grievances of the Ukrainians were very legitimate against Yanukovych, and it was very popular for a while, but it definitely got hijacked by, as these things tend to be, hijacked by, you know, a lot of very awful ultra-nationalist Russophobic forces and oligarchs and so on in Ukraine. After they overthrew Yanukovych, this could have been also deadly to Putin's rule and to his power and to his, you know, to people seeing him as a strong leader. And he turned it around and, you know, ramped up the culture war, the internal domestic culture war, to another level. Did what he, I really doubt he would have done this 10 years ago. He didn't act this way during the Orange Revolution 2004. He just took Crimea. And, you know, when's the last time something was done like that, where one country just took a piece of another country? I guess Saddam Hussein with Kuwait, and then, of course, Bush's invasion of Iraq. It's quite an extreme move to make. And, again, I don't think it's something that Putin, one, would have done, and there's no record of him doing something that extreme then. Now he's got the backing of the country, minus the liberals and the urban bourgeoisie, in a way he never had. His ratings are through the roof. He's practically won with the silent majority now. And, you know, and even our sanctions. I mean, Putin's, if you ask me, one of Putin's biggest worries right now would be, where are the oligarchs going to be on this, right? I mean, the oligarchs, I doubt, are very happy about this, because this means that, you know, they want to be international. They want their capital to be international. They want to be international. And now they have to actually make a choice. And there's sort of this this almost ritualistic thing going on with people who are getting slapped with sanctions where, you know, they basically say, well, I'm willing to be isolated and stuck in Russia and screw the West, screw the rest of the world. You know, I'm waiting to see what will happen if one big oligarch or, let's say, billionaire, whatever you call them in Russia, starts to rebel about that, over that, and says, I don't want to bring all my money back into Russia. What's going to happen with Prokhorov, who owns the, you know, the Brooklyn Nets, the basketball team here? Is he going to bring? Is he going to re-register the Brooklyn Nets in Moscow? So that's where things are going to get really interesting.
Right. Well, but in terms of the Ukraine, Mark Ames, it looks as though there could be a kind of bitter irony that the West will end up providing financial assistance to Ukraine, some of which will end up in Putin's coffers, because Putin's now demanding cash up front for the enormous gas debt. And it seems sort of at this point, at least to my mind, that the country's probably going to be dismembered. But I think what the real strategy on Putin's part is, it's what Mao Zedong's dictum was, hegemony without responsibility. He'd like to be able to influence and control Ukraine, but he doesn't want to be responsible for the bills, surely.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think he thought he had a better deal. I mean, what he's doing now is obviously much riskier. So down the line, this can all blow up potentially in his face. So I think he'd much prefer the situation with Yanukovych, a really corrupt quasi-vassal who ultimately was going to side with him. And I think even in eastern Ukraine, it's hard to tell. Really, I mean, Putin kind of like crossed a line that I hadn't seen him cross all these years, and he's crossed it, and I don't know, and I don't think people who I think used to think they knew, I don't think they know anymore what his ultimate intentions really are. I mean, I think it's clear that for him, this is an existential issue. And again, he's got the backing of most Russians on this, certainly the non-Moscow, non-liberal Russians. This is an existential issue. And so he's willing to go all the way to secure, you know, what he thinks is legitimately theirs, which would be the Russian-speaking pro-Russian parts of Ukraine. And we're not willing to, you know, which is, and so... I mean, you know, in some ways you have to just ask yourself again, what were we doing mucking around and heating things up? And I think we just don't really understand or appreciate what's going on inside of Russia. And we don't understand or appreciate, you know, how this could blow back in our faces, whoever's right or wrong in this. We're not willing to go to war. We're not willing to go to nuclear war or whatever over eastern Ukraine. And ultimately, the Ukrainians then are the ones who pay for this. You know, ultimately. So we heat things up and make some promises and then back away when it gets too hot. I find the whole thing really sordid. And ultimately, this is really, at least in the short term and probably midterm, this has only empowered the Kremlin, and it's pushed the Kremlin much further in this sort of right populist direction and towards a kind of like inward isolationism as well from the rest of the world. Like, I just don't see how that's good for us.
Exactly. Well, I think... But just in closing, Mark Ames, it's clear that in many ways we're reaping the whirlwind of dancing in the end zone, being the victors in the Cold War, not ponying up any help, expecting Russia to suddenly make itself into a liberal democracy overnight without any real assistance from the United States. We spent trillions winning the Cold War and wouldn't give them chump change. And they know that. And once the 1998 financial crash happened, I think that was totally the end of influence. And we've got something else, not what we bargained for, but it's what Russia has produced. And frankly, from a geopolitical point of view, I imagine it's very difficult for Western leaders to deal with this peculiar new hybrid of organized crime and national security, the mafia and nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think you're absolutely right. It was a huge, huge opportunity missed. It was almost like we couldn't help ourselves. You know, we had guys like Larry Summers just who looked at Russia as one giant banking opportunity and didn't really think about the interest of us and the Russians, you know, in the longer term. We're reaping the whirlwind. I agree.
Well, Mark Ames, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate your article and the conversation, and hopefully we can stay in touch.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Ames, who's the founding editor of the satirical Moscow biweekly, The Exile. He's a senior editor at Pando Daily and the author of Going Postal, Rage, Murder, and Rebellion, From Reagan's Workplaces to Clinton's Columbine, as well as co-authors of The Exile, Sex, Drugs, and Libel in the New Russia. His latest article at Pando Daily is Sorry, America, Ukraine Isn't All About You. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the Turkish Prime Minister, who appears to stumble from one crisis to another.
I have breathed all the sea. You're our fan prophecy. Our destiny we will not hide when the sun comes up. It will be on your side.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Asla Bali, who is a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses in public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war. She works, among other things, on Turkey and visits the country a lot. So tell me, Asla, how do you explain how this very charismatic, modernizing leader, Erdogan, who when he came on the scene, captured a lot of attention, but just in this last year, he just seems to go from one crisis to the other, and he seems to dig the hole deeper. And nothing could be more emblematic of that, given this horrible mining tragedy in Turkey, where the prime minister handling of it has just been appalling. His aide was captured on camera kicking a protester, and he himself slapped a protester in a local supermarket. All of these things, of course, have been shown on the media ad nauseum. So what's going on there?
So, as you say, Erdogan has had a remarkable year, which we're about to come on the anniversary of the Gezi protests that broke out last summer, which were basically protests against a number of different kinds of critiques of his regime. One aspect, the aspect that actually touched off those particular protests, had to do with the raising of parks and gentrification and urban development that has run rampant in Turkey under the AKP's government, which is the Prime Minister Erdogan's party, and has witnessed the radical privatization of state-held lands and other kinds of assets. That's what touched off those protests last year. And this mining accident actually connects and really is a bookend on the year, because we here see a massive failure to properly regulate an industry which has also witnessed tremendous amount of privatization, and specifically this mine in Soma, which was privatized in 2005, has been the subject of a lot of criticism around the failure to take basic precautions to protect workers. And so as this disaster now unfolds with, you know, over 280 confirmed dead, but very likely that number will rise well above 500 based on current estimates of as many as 800 miners in the mine and fewer than 160 rescued to date, we are witnessing the largest industrial accident in Turkey's Republican history, and one that is deeply connected to decisions by this government towards rampant privatization. So it's very much connected to the same sets of critiques that were launched last summer with the original protests. And of course, the response to those protests were a series of authoritarian statements and brutal police reaction and repression of protests. And what we're seeing here now is more of the same. So he comes to the site in order to survey the rescue efforts, but in fact belittles the losses of the people of this community by saying that this is a sort of ordinary accident that one might see anywhere, enraged and grieving family members then call out and accuse him of murder in the sense that they view this not so much as an accident, but as a man-made product of a failure to respect basic human rights, basic conditions that are necessary to secure labor protections. So they treat this as a massacre and not an accident. And once that happens, he's forced to retreat, and the retreat is angry and ugly, and his entourage lashes out, and he himself lashes out in the supermarket against any criticism. So this has become now the pattern that we see, which is defensiveness, a polarizing strategy. But the one thing about it that I think is worth noting is, so far, it has not redounded against the interests of either the prime minister himself personally, Erdogan, or his party. As we saw most recently in municipal elections in March, the party's popularity has survived. And the reason it has survived, I think, is because there is a certain logic to the polarization strategy that Erdogan pursues, which creates a kind of rally around the flag effect in his own base amongst his own constituents, and he maintains a level of popularity that secures something on the order of 45% to 50% of the electorate. And as a result, he really doesn't face an incentive to desist from these policies, which produce the very kind of photo ops you're describing and viral videos that you're describing of himself embattled and lashing out. And yet it doesn't capture the full picture of what's happening politically in Turkey, as there's an entire other segment of the society which regards attacks on the prime minister, attacks on this government, as politically motivated, as ideological, and as unfair.
Again, I'm speaking with Asla Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war, and also deals with Turkish issues and visits the country frequently. And we're talking about the Prime Minister's of Turkey's incredibly bungled response to this mining disaster, at which at least 280 people have died, 150 are still missing. This story will go on for some time. And he seems to be defying, according to what you've just told us, Asla Bali, he seems to be defying all of the rules of politics, because quite often these photo opportunities resulting from great calamities make or break politicians, whether it's George W. Bush standing next to the fireman at the smoke in front of the smoking ruins at 9/11, Bill Clinton at the bombing in Oklahoma, and conversely, the idea of the aide kicking a protester and the prime minister slapping a protester, it couldn't be more of a contrast. But your suggestion is that is this in the conservative countryside that you're talking about? In other words, is this one of those situations where the kind of intelligentsia and the urban folk are outraged, whereas the country folk stand by their man?
There is something like that happening here, where you do have a bit of an urban-rural dynamic, but I think that doesn't fully capture what's going on. And on the one hand, Erdogan rose on a wave of popularity that at one point included liberals, that included the intelligentsia, as you put it, and sort of the urban left, in part because the government presided over a period of liberalization in the first decade of the 2000s. But what's happened since then is just one thing after another, particularly intensely this year, that has struck against the image of Erdogan as competent, as liberalizing, as a effective administrator, and so forth. So all of the things that had caused many to rally around the party specifically as a liberalizing force, both politically and in the economic sphere, much of that has now been dented. But having said that, there is a core set of support for Erdogan from the right in the country, and it's not only in rural areas. I mean, there's a huge level of support in many urban areas, and Turkey is a country whose major cities have been transformed in the last 30 years by a mass internal migration from rural areas to the cities, and so we have very large cities that have a very mixed demographic. There's a lot of support for Erdogan in cities as well, and the support comes, among other things, from religious and conservative elements of Turkish society. And some of the focus for them is the ongoing management of the economy, as an example, where there has been an overall improvement, I think, in the quality of life for many across the country because of improvements in things like health services, basic public infrastructure, investment in municipalities, and so on. And so the AKP, the idea has been that the AKP has been a more competent manager than the alternatives. And one reason why Erdogan is able to maintain support is because of what the alternatives look like in the Turkish political spectrum. On the one hand, you have the sort of center-left, which remains quite poorly organized, not extraordinarily good at building coalition in the country. And generally speaking, the country votes center-right. So that's been true for much of the history of the Republic, that if you can get a coalition that consolidates the center-right in the country, then you're able to prevail in elections. And the genius of Erdogan and of his party has been to really build a coalition, a party that brings under its tent the business community, the religious and conservative elements of the society, and others that historically vote center-right under the big tent of the AKP. So it's not, I think, right to think of it as, for example, an Islamist party. It's much more diversified than that, the kind of coalition they've built around the party, and that retains a durable electoral majority even in the face of what we're seeing at this point, because there isn't a clear alternative for which that constituency is prepared to vote. And against this backdrop, Erdogan has, moreover, really deployed polarization in his favor. I mean, to the extent that he's polarizing and he has a constituent base that reliably returns at least sort of half of the electorate, he has no reason to sort of deflect from the trajectory he's moving on today. He is an astute politician, and the images that you're describing of, you know, a Clinton or a George W. Bush, in this instance, what is a possibility, and what he has successfully managed to do in much of the past year, is to turn what appears to be a kind of devastating indictment to his own advantage by portraying himself as the victim. So it's too soon now to say whether he will succeed with a strategy again in Soma. But for example, as the images broke in December of 2013 of senior cabinet members and their family facing police raids with, you know, shoeboxes full of cash being found and a massive corruption scandal exploding in Turkey, very quickly, Erdogan was able to shape that narrative into one of victimization and one of a kind of conspiracy against the government. And that ended up having some resonance. It hasn't persuaded everyone. People don't think that this government is, you know, free from corruption. But they also believe that there's something behind the investigations, the police raids, the coordinated police action against a number of the cabinet members at a given time, and the leaks to YouTube and on Twitter that have enabled the sort of airing of these public corruption allegations through leaked wiretapped phone conversations. All of that, which I think in another context would have been devastating and would certainly have resulted in electoral defeat, was actually transformed by Erdogan into a narrative again that said, our constituency is under attack, the traditional elites are on the offensive, they want to deprive us of our ability to participate fully in the political spectrum, and we have to resist. And that proved relatively effective. That, combined with the fact that the AKP has done a relatively good job in municipal governance in many of the cities, meant that they were able to weather that storm. The next round of electoral challenge that the AKP will face is a presidential election that's coming up at the end of this summer, and we don't yet know whether the prime minister plans to run as a presidential candidate, but it is a strong possibility, one among several different possibilities of where his ambition will take him next. And a question that arises is whether, as you say, the image that he's projecting now of a defensive politician lashing out against grieving mourners of a horrific industrial catastrophe will play against him. But, you know, what the lessons of the last year suggest is that he may yet find a way to somehow turn this to his advantage.
So what role then does the exiled religious figure in rural Pennsylvania, who seems to be very much under the skin of Prime Minister Erdogan, Gulen, and his followers, when you say that the religious and conservative people support Erdogan, yet this religious figure seems to be vehemently opposed to him and certainly is getting under his skin. So what is the schism there?
So the Gulen movement represents one tendency among a kind of broader swath of religious and conservative elements that support this government. And certainly it was a tendency that participated in helping the government secure electoral victory after electoral victory in national elections, the three rounds that they've participated in to date. There was an expectation when the split occurred between the Gulen movement and the Erdogan-aligned affiliated AKP that it might translate into a change at the polls. That did not materialize in the local elections. So to step back to your question, what we're seeing is a sort of fight within the AKP or within the camp that has historically supported the AKP that I think represents something very healthy for Turkish, the Turkish political spectrum and for Turkish democracy. If the story I told you a moment ago is right, which is that any politician or political party that's able to consolidate the center-right will secure a durable electoral majority, that represents a real problem for competitive politics, because if any party has a durable electoral majority, then they stop having to compromise, they stop having to enter into political bargaining or negotiation with the other part of the political spectrum. And even if you can consolidate 51% of the country, if you're excluding 49% from meaningful participation, you have a real breakdown in democratic politics. And that is, I think, the scenario that Turkey has faced since the 2011 elections and the consolidation, the real consolidation of this majority in favor of the AKP. So the best thing that could happen, I think, is a split from within the AKP to reintroduce competitive politics by reintroducing some fractures in the center-right itself and producing other competing tendencies and alternatives for this part of the Turkish constituency to consider in their voting behavior. And that, I think, is what the split with Erdogan suggests as a possibility. I'm not sure that the Gulen movement itself is powerful enough to create an alternative political formation or political party, but it begins to give you a sense that there are some fractures within the coalition that Erdogan built and that it's not necessarily as durable as it appeared, at least in the last few years. And this split occurred for a number of reasons, including a belief amongst Erdogan and his supporters that the Gulen forces had infiltrated important parts of the state bureaucracy and the police forces and the intelligence wings of the government, and that they represented an internal threat. They responded to that in part by seeking to shut down one of the main sources of both funding and support for the Gulen movement, their school system in Turkey, which involves preparatory academies for university to prepare students for university exams and so on. They announced that they were going to crack down on these schools. And then a few months after that announcement, you had suddenly these images of pre-dawn police raids on cabinet members' homes. So all of this brought to the surface or made public what appears to be dimensions of a split. Pinning down exactly how influential the Gulen movement is or exactly the circumstances of the split is very difficult, because it is a movement that is to some extent organized in a way that makes it quite opaque and difficult to fully understand, and it's hard to assess whether the kind of claims that Erdogan and the government are making about the power of this movement are accurate or overblown. But the one thing that is clear is that there has been a split within the party from amongst a group that at one point contributed to building the majority that Erdogan depends on. And that split, to my mind, represents something that could potentially be quite positive. At a minimum, it's exposed corruption, and that's certainly a good thing. But perhaps in the longer run, it also creates the possibility that the AKP may lose some of its sway on the center-right, and we may enter into a period where the party has to think about building coalitions again with other political parties and therefore abandon the kind of authoritarian tone that Erdogan is now exemplifying and turn back to a politics of compromise.
Well, Asla Bali, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Asla Bali, who's a professor at the UCLA School of Law, where she teaches courses on public international law, international human rights, and the laws of war, and also deals with Turkish issues and visits Turkey often. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Don't talk about the whole
time will